To order the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee of Ways and Means. This is Monday, April 21st, 2003, and we will continue today with a public hearing on House Bill 5009, the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development Budget Bill. Before I open the public hearing, Mr. Bender, do you have any information for the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, members. Good morning. This is the second of the last day of the public hearing on the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. This will be the final day of presentation. Tomorrow will be a day you'll be taking public testimony. Then beginning on Wednesday, you start with the budgets of the Department of Education, Operation, and Grant and Aid Programs. I just wanted to point out one thing that was distributed to you this morning that you'll find in your packet of materials, not in your packet of materials, but under your agenda, and that is a chart that looks like this that's labeled Agricultural Research Foundation. This was distributed. The chair had asked Dean Dutson of the Agricultural Experiment Station to provide information on contributions to the Agricultural Experiment Station. This is not a community college information. This harkens back to last week when you were looking at the statewide public services. But this chart shows a list of agricultural and natural resource associations and the contributions that they have made to help support the Agricultural Experiment Station of OSU. And also on the second page, this shows the information on the value of their production. So you can look at both the size of their industry and the contributions that they've been making in support of the Agricultural Experiment Station.
Thank you, Mr. Bender. And with that, I'll open the public hearing on House Bill 5009 and call forward Ms. Pruce-Brawley from the Commissioner of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We would like to start today with a review of the budget notes that the department left the 2001 session with. That copy of a document dated April 15th should be at your place, because we did have six budget notes. It seemed important to single them out and have a discussion with the committee as we begin. I'm going to walk quickly through them. Are you finding them?
Yeah. No. What does it look like? Do you have a?
It has a cover letter that looks like this, dated April 15th. It came the very first day, but we didn't. We didn't cover it.
So that would be behind tab one in our book.
Likely so. That's true.
Okay. That's where it is.
Oh yes, members. It is behind tab one of your budget hearings book, and it is after page. There are 27 numbered pages, and then an affirmative action report, and then it follows that.
Okay.
I think we are. That's not it.
This is not it?
No.
Oh boy. Wait a minute.
Ready.
Okay. The cover letter just walks through the different budget notes that were provided. The attached sheets then give you some detail about the status of each budget note. I'm going to move directly to the attachment. The department shall provide support and financial assistance to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission in preparing a report on the impact of student financial aid on student attendance and persistence. You will note at the bottom of page three of that attachment that the Student Assistance Commission has finished that report, and it is available online, and we did provide both staff assistance for that report. The next budget was regarding, budget note was regarding performance measures. We did have a budget note at some length that because of the $45 million increase to the Community College Support Fund, there was an expectation that more students would be served, and the budget note details that expectation. The status of that report is that year-end reports for 2001-02 indicate that Community College did serve 97,528 reimbursable full-time students, was an increase of over 7%. The actual detail of certificate and licensure rates are not, and distance learning are not yet complete for the biennium, but we do anticipate that because of the influx of funds for 01-02 and then a decrease of funds 02-03, that we likely will not maintain that increase in students, but we fully expect not to see a decrease in the quality of the service to those students. Moving on to page 5, we had a budget note that would, with regard to the department, will not seek additional funds from the emergency board during the interim for enrollment-related costs. No action was required and certainly none taken. The budget note on page 6 of the attachment is regarding Spanish language speakers. The department was directed to work with the Department of Education and the Oregon University System to develop and support programs designed to prepare native Spanish language speakers for teaching careers in the state's public school system. I would say that in meeting with those two partners, we determined that the way in which we could provide most assistance was the preparation of Spanish language speakers for teaching careers, was to focus on paraprofessionals as required by No Child Left Behind. We do have two colleges that have programs that are specifically targeted to with multicultural programs for paraprofessionals. That would be Chemeketa Community College working with the Woodburn School District. And Treasure Valley Community College has a bilingual instructional assistance program that's being developed and demonstrated through a grant. We don't yet have sufficient information or data to report on these two, but we feel confident that this action will increase the preparation of Spanish speakers in the teaching ranks. The next budget note, which is on page 7, is regarding health care issues. The committee was concerned about the impact of the shortage of qualified health care professionals and encouraged the department to promote, with funds from the Title I-B of the Workforce Investment Act, programs to train healthcare professionals, and especially programs designed to expedite training and accommodate student work schedules. This is an area where the department has spent a considerable time, energy, and resources, and have in fact crafted with with our private sector partners a community college healthcare action plan. It does define specific shortage areas where we will target resources to ensure that students have coursework available to them and that it is provided in an expeditious manner. We are not just using the federal workforce investment dollars, but also Carl Perkins professional technical resources to support the colleges as they build this action plan. We have a full-fledged, this action plan is printed up, and it would be available if the members of the committee are interested. And the last budget note is actually a considerably larger report. It was regarding charge the department, find the actual language here. shall work with the Employment Department and with the workforce-related programs of the Department of Human Services to coordinate and prioritize workforce-related services with particular attention to placement, training, and job retention services, and to avoid unnecessary duplication of services. This report was undertaken and available for the Emergency Board because of special sessions. It was delayed in its delivery, but it was, in fact, available. What we used to prepare this report was the statewide reporting system called CIS, which is, I'm not going to be able to remember what the acronym stands for. Shared Information System. Thank you. Little chorus behind me. The committee may remember earlier when we talked about federal workforce training programs that the Workforce Investment Act, Title I-B, has 17 performance measures. The Carl Perkins Professional Technical Act has at least 8 or 9. Adult Basic Services and Family Literacy Act has its own set of at least a half a dozen. What the Shared Information System does is conglomerates the information into one, what we used to call a black box, because it does hold confidential the identity of the individual, but it is able to report in the aggregate the people that come into the system and flow out of the system, whether they got a job, retained that job, whether they increased in their skills, what services were provided for them. So we have invested our federal resources and some state resources some years ago in the building of this shared information system for the purpose of tracking Oregon's performance as a workforce system rather than as individual siloed programs. That information system did provide for us the vehicle for this report in case members of the committee are also dealing with committees that deal with the Employment Department. We are transitioning from the shared information system to another system, another data system, but I won't bore you with that detail at this moment. What we found in doing this report was that over time, and specifically over about the last 5 years, and particularly with the passage of the Workforce Investment Act that called for a greater level of partnership at both the state and local level, is that agencies that deliver certain workforce services have begun to specialize. So when you look through the report, you will find that the Employment Department does the majority of placement activities in the state. Adult and Family Services, or what was Adult and Family Services, of the Department of Human Resources, Children and Families, does the majority of assessment of where is an individual at this particular place in time and what services do they need to become self-sufficient. The community colleges do the majority, I'd say 97%, of the training, workforce training, that happens in the state. But what we were able to determine in the research and development of this report was, yes, there is duplication that occurs across the workforce system, but it's primarily driven by specific requirements of the federal acts, and because each of these populations do have targeted services that must happen for them in order for them to receive resources and funding. But when it came to the actual service level, those agencies that have a specialty are really doing the majority of the work when it comes to if a student needs training or a participant or a customer needs training. It is the community college that does it, and there isn't a hue and cry to have that be delivered by the Department of Human Services or the Employment Department. They leave the training to us, if you will. So that's the 6 budget notes that the department worked on in the interim, and I'd be happy to answer
questions or comments from the committee members on the budget notes. Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. First of all, I would like to acknowledge President Carrion. the article in the Oregonian a few days ago acknowledging the leadership of this community college president, I thought was just wonderful and extraordinary, and it spoke to a quality of leadership that we have out there in our community colleges. And with the president Carrion sitting here, I just didn't want to miss an opportunity to acknowledge that. Looking at the budget note related to Spanish language speakers and just scanning the material that's here, I don't see a reference to partnering with independent institutions. And when we consider that independent institutions, and I think this is still true, turn out a majority of our teachers, it just seems that there's an opportunity there to also partner with our private institutions. Mm-hmm. We talk, Madam Chair, often about aspiring to achieve a seamless educational system, pre-K through higher ed, and that seamless system should include our private institutions as well. So again, I would not want us to miss an opportunity for collaboration.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I will need to confirm this, but I have a memory that when this group was convened, it did include independent colleges, because as you say, they have a share of this particular preparation market. But I will confirm that.
And to follow up, Madam Chair, in this particular budget note report, I don't see a reference to the recent minority teacher report either. And I'm just assuming that you are also involved in those efforts, and it would be helpful if you would talk about that role and also include that information as a part of this budget note report, if in fact you are playing an active role.
Madam Chair, yes, Senator Gordley, yes, we are. I'm very familiar with the minority teacher report, and I guess by way of explanation, this report item was developed before that report was delivered, but we will certainly make an addendum to that.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions or comments? Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move now to a letter in response to questions when we left on Thursday. This is a fairly large packet. The first item was the affirmative action plan that Senator Gordley had asked be delivered. You will find that as Attachment A. I think it is important that I note for the committee and to Senator Gordley personally, is that in reviewing our affirmative action plan that we had presented as part of the budget documents, and rereading it, we found that it was a rather passive document, and we certainly heard you loud and clear, detailed and aggressive, and we think that we have at least taken a step in that direction with the document that you now have in front of you.
Madam Chair,
Senator Gore,
thank you. Since we're just receiving this this morning, could you summarize for the record what is in this report?
Yes.
And again, I'm assuming that this is a document that was created in response to the question that we raised.
Yes, Chair Morgan and Senator Gordley, yes, this is new.
Okay. Walk us through it, please.
I would be pleased to.
Thank you.
As I said, in overview, let's start with the purpose. The purpose is to communicate the department's commitment to affirmative action and to develop an affirmative action commitment and target plan to increase racial, ethnic, disabled, and gender diversity of department staff to increase the awareness and competence of the department staff on issues of diversity and to develop and implement specific recruitment, selection, and retention strategies designed to attract, hire, and retain a diverse staff. In order to do that, we believe that there are some essential elements. One is to communicate our commitment. We believe that the development of a plan needs to be an annual plan, not a biennial plan. It needs to be adopted by the management team and the labor management committee within our department. It needs to be annually reviewed with all staff. It needs to be on our website. We just need to be more proactive in our enunciation of our commitment. The second element is active recruitment. We're tasking our personnel director to pursue overt and aggressive recruitment strategies. We have in the past used diversity publications, but again, it has been more as a passive action, not assertive. We're going to change that. We have begun the development of a diversity network, but we will ramp up our actions there. We will ensure that we are the ones that are doing the check-in. We won't wait to be checked in with. We will be the one who's knocking on the door. We want to create opportunities that will bring diversity to our staff. We currently hire primarily at the entry-level ranks and management staff, although management openings are not have not happened in about the last 6 or 8 months. But given that, we believe there are other ways to ensure that diverse candidates have an opportunity, and we would do that through internships, through cooperative work experience, and the development of a mentorship program. We will set targets for ourselves. We will develop a template around affirmative action checklists to use with supervisors as they open positions. Again, rather than a passive approach, we will proceed aggressively. Likewise, in the selection process and in retention strategies, we want to really ensure that when we have diverse staff, that we keep them, and we'll do that again by peer mentors and increasing coaching and other activities that are known to be successful in retaining high-quality staff. And the last element is accountability. We will ensure that the personnel director is reporting our progress on a regular basis, and that I will be presenting this information to the State Board of Education. They are likewise interested in diversity, not just in staff, but across the college campuses. And we will return with the affirmative action plan the next legislative session.
Very good, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the work.
Thank you. The next item in the response letter is questions raised by Chair Morgan on around self-improvement. What we have provided for you here is considerable background on how we got to this place with self-improvement classes. The first several paragraphs are our attempt to bring to the attention of the committee the statutory language that we have been operating under up to the beginning of the special sessions and really conversation that occurred in the last legislative session, particular to self-improvement classes. The statutory language does direct that the distribution of state aid is done through the State Board of Education and the Commissioner by the adoption of rules. It is only specific in what in statute, it is only specific in what we will not reimburse for, and that is hobby and recreation. That's the only exclusion. Continuing on to page 2 of the letter, we have the self-improvement courses really did not come into vogue. It wasn't a word that was used. They were called other education courses for many, many years until about 1987-88 when the department began using it as a way to classify courses in our biennial profile that we prepare, which is a look at who is taking courses, what kind of courses, at what colleges across the state. I bring your attention to the center of page 2, the indented material, which is other education courses. This is defined as general self-improvement courses intended primarily for adults and independent of professional technical lower division curricula. They are not intended for programs that lead to a baccalaureate degree. They are courses that are used as prerequisites or elective courses for a professional technical degree or a certificate program. Other education courses include instruction not otherwise included in professional technical or lower division collegiate categories. As I said, the term self-improvement didn't really become a subcategory of or a reimbursement category until the late 80s. That's when we began to delineate what kind of other education courses were being provided, and they include adult education, GED, post-secondary remediation, adult high school, and self-improvement. It seemed important back then to break out what kind of self-improvement and other education colleges were expending their resources and energies on. At the bottom of page 2 is a discussion of the special session cuts from special session number 5, specified that self-improvement courses, other than those termed workforce, health, and safety, were not to be applied in the subcategories of other education. In other words, the department could reimburse for workforce health and safety, but whatever else was in that category needed to be reviewed and refined and perhaps no longer reimbursed. We do have attachments B and C, which show you how the subcategories were defined and the individual cuts to colleges is attachment C. When we proceeded to take the cut, the $9.3 million cut in special as specified by special session number 5, and we held harmless the workforce health and safety, there were not remaining enough other education courses to fulfill the $9.3 million, at least as we had them so categorized at the time. So we did, in fact, reduce some of what we would call reimbursable non-credit arts and sciences courses, because we had taken out all those in our audit. We had taken out all those that we thought were miscategorized as reimbursable when they should have been non-reimbursable, and found that even after having done that to what we thought the committee had asked, we did not have enough FTE to amount to 9.3. So we did begin a reduction in the non-credit arts and arts and sciences area. I think it's important that the committee know that arts and sciences, they are important and valuable to the students, both because they are both of academic and civic interest. They are in a non-credit format, and they do develop a broad range of knowledge and skill development. They do provide support or an experience for students who have not yet entered credit programs to see what going to college is all about. And sometimes taking a non-credit course is less threatening than a credit course if you haven't been to school for a while. The term self-improvement has over time come to, we believe, to be mixed with the non-reimbursable category of hobby and recreation. They are very different things. They are, self-improvement and hobby and recreation are all included in the college catalog. And that could help add to the confusion because the state does not reimburse everything that is in that catalog. I might point you to last Thursday when Peggy Falkenstein from Clackamas was trying to make the point that the work that she did in customized training was rarely found in the college catalog because they are self-support courses. I think to finish in this particular topic, the State Board of Education and the department would advocate to this committee that if the Community College Support Fund must be reduced, that you provide the department and the State Board the opportunity to make those reductions instead of specifying a particular category of reimbursables, simply because of the way in which colleges build their budget. And you heard that both from President Levine and President Spilde when they were here on Thursday about because the state provides a set of funding no matter what the course is and really no matter what the cost of the course, if it's reimbursable, right now it's about $2,100. And if it's a professional technical course that costs $6,000 or $8,000, the college is responsible for balancing the budget. And they do that by offering a range of courses. So again, the department would advocate recognizing that the co-chairs have produced a budget that does have a specific category. We would hope that our explanation this morning has helped you see, and that of the testimony from last week, that by picking a particular category and our pledge that we have audited that category and are comfortable with the courses that are in there, that they are within the reimbursable category, that you would allow the State Board of Education and the department to make any reduction that was necessary.
Mr. Bender, do you have a comment?
I would... I understand what the request is, as I'm sure you do as well, but I think that, as you look into this further in work session, do understand that the impact of making decisions of which courses you wish to apply state funding to for and which you do not could impact on the mix of courses that community colleges would provide at any given level of funding. So even if the total dollar amount were to be the same under two scenarios, one where you specified that you did not believe that the state should be funding a particular type of course, where on the other hand, you just provide the same amount of dollars and tell the state board to distribute the funds as they would, this could change the distribution of funds between colleges and change the courses that they would offer. So if you do believe as a policy reason that there are certain courses that you do think that the colleges should support, should operate on a self-support basis and that they should not be receiving additional state general fund for offering, that you continue to look at it in that manner. Indeed, statutorily, there was already a restriction against funding of the so-called hobby classes. I think the commissioner was saying that some of the other classes, which were categorized as self-improvement, they had found after auditing these, that those were indeed hobby courses that should not have been funded under the under statute, and they switched them to a non-reimbursable, from reimbursable to non-reimbursable in terms of the distribution formula. I think that you should listen to what the commissioner is saying, but also note that, as you know, the legislature, if you do wish to direct the funding to particular type of courses, that would be totally appropriate to do.
I concur with Mr. Bender. I think that it is within the purview of the legislature to direct where we think the education funding should be going. But I realize, too, that because of the diversity of campuses and the challenge that you have with paying for the very high-cost technical classes, that you need to maintain some discretion over how you mix the funds. So I think we're going to have to find some place in the middle where we're happy that the community colleges are going in a workforce and college prep kind of direction and go from there. The committee isn't very talkative this morning.
You're doing fine, Madam Chair.
Please proceed. Representative Bates had a number of questions on property tax assessments, so I'm hoping we're going to move in that direction.
Madam Chair, yes, we were able to find some of the information since last Thursday, but not completely. We do have some contained in here. The Representative Morgan asked a question about what exactly did the small base factor look like. So on page 4, you will see that the we have indicated the range of full-time equivalents and what the college factor, the college size factor, also that corresponds to that number of FTE. And to reiterate, each college does receive currently $610 per full-time equivalent for the first 1,100. Colleges that have fewer than 1,100 full-time equivalents receive $610 for all of their FTE, and that is what constitutes the base. You have then, in the middle of page 4, just a sampling of what that base factor ends up looking like by college. And I'd be...
So if I'm to read this matrix correctly, what you're saying then is for Oregon Coast College, they have just under 500 FTE, which in their base budget brings them just over $303,000. And then there's also a 1.35 factor applied to the base, which brings their total adjusted base up to $409,000.
Madam Chair, that's correct. The size factor was developed because we believed that the larger a college got, the more economies of scale they might be able to find. So you'll find that the largest college, which is Portland Community College, receives 610 for the first 1,100, but they receive nothing in a base factor because we believe they likely have the best ability to, through their purchasing power, to achieve economies of scale that the small colleges could not.
Are there any other adjustment factors besides small campus factor that you adjust the distribution formula by?
Madam Chair, yes, there is something that, because the formula was implemented over a five-year time span and we didn't just rush to implementation, we have something that's called the gap. And the gap says that if we had rushed to implementation, certain schools would have lost more resources because, remember, we were at a floor and a cap, and in our effort to distribute approximately the same dollar amount for each student, some colleges were going to lose money over time if they were at the high end of that cap. per student. So we used a gap and a gap to step them down to that cost per student or the reimbursement per student, so it didn't happen all at once. And others, some colleges that lost through the gap, the colleges that had a lower cost per student gained a little. So over the years, we have attempted to do this.
Could you bring us a matrix for the campuses that shows where people are in relation to the gap or where the campuses are in relation?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that. Yes.
Just understand that concept better.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Gordley.
I need help understanding something you said previously. Colleges over 1,000 FTE, or the larger colleges, the example you gave was Portland, receive nothing after a certain point because of the belief that, and could you restate the belief? That's what I'm having difficulty grasping.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, before I go there, the base factor used to be, I think we actually said this last Thursday, it used to be a flat $400, no matter the size of the college, for the first 1,100 FTE. So if you, so in this example, Oregon Coast would have, for its 497.16 full-time equivalents, would have received $400 for each one of them. We began using an inflation factor because that $400 had been the same, as far as we could tell, for the last 15 years. And we did believe that there had been some inflationary increases on that base. We worked with a consultant to try to arrive at, if we were going to increase the base, what was the most fair way to do that. And we started with the premise that the larger a college was, the more likely they were to have economies of scale, that, you know, that they could buy 150 computers where a small college might be buying 10, and that the discount might get deeper for every 10 or 15 or 20 that you purchased. The college size factor was then determined with the help of this consultant and work that he had done in other states to help come to a place where it is apparently common understanding that a college 5,000 or over has reached a place where they are receiving enough, I dare to tread here, but are receiving enough from state support and other sources such as tuition that they are at a break-even place. But before they get there, the service to each student is a little higher the smaller that you are. So that's how we arrived at the range, the FTE range, how we broke it out, and the size factor.
So then, Madam Chair, to follow up, is there evidence to support the belief, again, that the larger a college is, the more likely that college is to have economies of scale? I'm just trying to probe here to understand if there's evidence to support the belief.
Representative Morgan and Senator Gordley, we believe there is. I would need to and would be happy to bring you the report that we received from the consultant that is the basis for this base.
And who was that consultant?
It was Madam Chair, Senator Gordley. It was a firm called Stratus, and they are from California. They had done work in a number of states with community college systems.
And when was that report prepared?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, it was prepared, I believe, in 2000, perhaps early 2001.
All right. I'll stop there, Madam Chair.
Moving on to the property tax question, Representative March had asked to see charts with funding levels where we would include all of the property taxes So we have included four charts that detail that information, and those are begin with attachment D. So attachment D should look familiar. It was presented on Thursday with the effect of no property taxes in the formula, and it shows you public support by FTE high to low. Attachment E.
So what this shows then is all campuses keep their property taxes. Is that what this is?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And then how do you figure the state support? Is it just per student?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And attachment E was also presented on Thursday. This is the 50% of property taxes in the formula. So that would be our current. And then attachment F is all property taxes in the formula.
Madam Chair, I do note that the range of public support gets smaller. In other words, there's less difference under the all property tax in the formula system.
Steve, go ahead.
Yes, that would be correct, and I do believe that on the chart you're looking at now, the main reason for why there's any difference remaining at all would be probably the small school factor that you were just discussing.
That's right.
Because these aren't total funding. They're funding for FTE, so a small college like Oregon Coast is getting sort of, you might want to think of it as a small school adjustment, even though that's not the term that's actually used.
Thank you, Steve.
Madam Chair.
Senator Mesley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to restate what I said, I think, last Thursday, that the crux of this whole problem is about Measure 5. When the local community college boards were not able to raise their tax base. And so I'm, again, restate my concern that if we're going to fix this inequity, we ought to be thinking about, somebody in this body ought to be thinking how to allow community colleges to, if they have a need, to increase their tax bases, as opposed to taking money out of some communities that have made a commitment and are struggling to maintain that commitment.
Please proceed.
I think we're drawing near the end of this voluminous letter. At the bottom of page 4, Senator Meserly had asked for the history of tuition increases, and that is included as attachment H. You have, Madam Chair, you have seen, members of the committee, you have seen this particular chart displayed in other ways. We haven't done it specifically by college, rather than we have produced it as a statewide average. But I think as you look down each column year for year, the increases were fairly unremarkable. That's probably said as a student, I would admit, until you get to 2001. And 2002, and look at the increases in the last year.
We're looking at this chart here.
Attachment H, yes.
Representative Bates, I think, specifically asked if it was possible to get information on what an average assessed household would pay. Mm-hmm. Do you have anything like that? Were you able to get anything?
Madam Chair, we are still working on that particular response with Department of Revenue, and we don't have we don't think we have an adequate response yet. Okay. The hard data is hard at this moment. So with your indulgence, we would like to bring that back.
And I think that Representative Bates was interested in having that information and then comparing it with the information on the cost per credit hour that you have.
Yes, ma'am. The last item in the letter was Carl Perkins' performance, and Senator Gordley had asked us to unpack the particular measure that looked at placement and retention. Again, we do have an attachment, and that's attachment I. What we are looking at on attachment I is by college, the performance of Perkins post-secondary completers in either post-secondary education or in a job 1 year after exiting school. So you have the first column gives you the information by college, the students by college. The total that were reported to moving on into further post-secondary education, the total that were reported to have employment, and then the last category, the 88.07%, is really a subset of the 28%. The total reported in further post-secondary education. So if they continued on in post-secondary education, 88% of them were either employed or continuing in their education. And we apologize that the way in which these columns are displayed makes the information difficult to assimilate, that we were unable to move the data around in making sense? Not really.
Well, I'm squinting at various spreadsheets here. Questions on any of the information that was presented in response to our questions? I think we'll just await the arrival of that detailed information on the property taxes against the assessed values.
Yes, ma'am.
Please proceed.
Okay. I'm going to start now with the packet, the presentation materials. We have not necessarily talked in this forum about the reductions that have come to the agency. We have spent considerable time discussing the reductions and their impact on the community colleges. This is a slide that just attempts to articulate the reductions that have been taken by the department. We have we're now entering with an operating budget at 87% of what it was at the finish of the 2001 session, and there are further reductions slated for in both the co-chair's budget and the governor's budget that was announced on Friday. This is an organizational chart which shows you what we are attempting to do, somewhat limited by our graphics here on the organizational chart, to show you the bits and pieces of people who are funded with the general fund. So there is not a lot deeper that the agency can go in reducing our operating budget without also reducing agency staff. I just wanted to make sure that our concern about that reduction made it into the committee record. We currently handle $400 million with bits and pieces of seven people, and I think we are strained to maintain the level of accountability that we believe is necessary and believe that both the governor and the legislature expect from the department. I just wanted to make sure that you were aware of that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Mazzarelli.
As I look through your organization chart, I believe you have 13 managers out of, was it 47 employees? I think that computes to a 2.6 ratio of management to employees. I believe the governor has asked agencies to try to get to a 1 to 10 ratio. Could you explain the difference in your organization?
Madam Chair, Senator Mazzarelli, I will certainly attempt to. We have two manager, actually, we have, yes, we have two manager positions that are being re-evaluated and will be moved to classified positions in our reorganization beginning in 2001. We were unable to move those two positions, but we have since had retirements, and our intention is to move those into the classified ranks.
And which two positions are those?
In my eyes, we have a principal executive manager E, basic skills and literacy director. It's the fourth column, second box.
Okay.
Brett, can you help me with the second one? The OICC executive director is currently a management position, and we would expect to move that to a classified staff, not necessarily change the level, but the reporting of that individual to the agency.
And what's your timeline for reclassifying these positions?
Madam Chair, our hope was by the 1st of July with the entrance of the new biennium.
Madam Chair, follow-up?
Follow-up.
That would change your ratios somewhat, but you'd still be rather high for manager to employee ratios.
Madam Chair, Senator Mazzarelli, I am aware of that. We had organized ourselves thusly in as we moved to integrate the different programs that we had. We do not assume that this will be our final organization, and actually have one other management retirement that will occur. Then we would we are evaluating whether we believe we need a manager position there. We just have from at least my vantage point many different demands on the agency, and have done our level best to ensure accountability and not asking people to take on responsibility that is of a management level without providing them sufficient reimbursement and authority, line of authority. But it is something that we are certainly paying attention to.
Thank you.
I'm curious about the kinds of services that you provide to the campuses. Do you do any kind of bookkeeping services for any of the campuses at all, payroll functions or ledger functions?
Madam Chair, no, we do not. They have their own financial and business operations internal to each college. We have a data system, and we have and we require their revenue and expenditure reports to be delivered to us annually, and we do review them, but their finances, they also have, each college, of course, has a audit and is held to state budgeting laws, but we do not participate in their actual finances.
I noticed that a good part of this is education and workforce coordination. And I'm looking at the fourth and the fifth columns. Can you talk to us about what that section does, that it is so large?
Madam Chair, I certainly can. The column 4 has primarily federally funded staff who deliver services around adult basic skills and family literacy. We have considerable leadership responsibilities from that federal act around professional development of literacy instructors, as well as just grant and reporting responsibilities. We also have responsibilities under the Workforce Investment Act around youth councils and the coordination of youth services. The fifth column then is particular to the Workforce Investment Act one-stop services. We currently have, as we reported to the committee on Wednesday, 7 workforce investment areas in the state. We have a staff person here in the fifth column who has responsibilities not just for layoff and layoff aversion when a plant were to close down and people would find themselves dislocated, but also technical assistance responsibilities to ensure that best practices and reporting and audit and monitoring functions are all happening in those 7 different areas as per both federal and state regulation. So we have a fairly heavy staffing around the Workforce Investment Act because, quite frankly, that's what it takes in order to ensure that we have the proper level of accountability that both the governor, the legislature, and the Federal Department of Labor are looking for.
Thank you.
We'd like to move now to community colleges. We have, I'm afraid I'm going to probably move through this information quickly because we do have some guests that we would like to be able to share their experience at the community college with the committee. Slide number 4 is a display, and the colors with which we have shown you a whole number and a percentage are probably difficult to read on the slide, but in your handout, what we've attempted to show you is the total number of students by county that are enrolled in a community college, and then the percent of the population of that county. And we do this in an effort to show what we call market saturation for each community college. And as you can see along the coast, we have some very high percentages, 16% in Clatsop, 15% Tillamook, 17% in Coos Bay, 16% Douglas County. Moving inland, it remains reasonably high. Benton and Lynn at 14%, nearly 15%, and then 14%. Marion at 12. I'm not going to read them all to you. I just wanted to make sure that we were highlighting both coastal and not to forget Malheur County at 12.1% on the east side. So it's just a picture of the number, of, given the population of a county, what percentage of that population actually avails themselves to a community college.
Have you done any kind of analysis to show why there the usage appears to be concentrated in the western part of the state? And it's interesting that Josephine and Jackson and Klamath even kind of draw a line, and it falls off quite substantially once you cross over the Cascades. Is it an issue of geography?
Madam Chair, I think a guesstimate would be that it is somewhat limited by geography and the distance one must travel, or the availability of distance learning is not as dense as it might be in a more populated area. Slide number 5 is just a picture of all students served in the 2001-02 year by college. So, again, you see a large diversity of service, and, of course, that is primarily driven by the population. Slide number 6 gives you a picture of the 400,000 students served by community colleges and their age range. We attempt here to show you those that are of transfer age, primarily the 102 that are 18 to 24. That would be the lower division students who likely are looking to pursue a four-year baccalaureate. And then the large portion, 25 to really 64, a large portion of age. A large portion of the students at community colleges are mature adults. Slide 7 shows you the increase in student demand over the last decade. There have students' growth has exceeded 86,000 students in the last 10 years.
Madam Chair.
Senator Mesley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you project that into the coming biennium?
Madam Chair, Senator Mesley, you're one slide ahead of me. Here we have our enrollment scenario, as was included in our agency request, that we expected that by the end of the 05 biennium, 03-05 biennium, we would be at nearly 106,000 students.
Madam Chair?
Follow up?
And the clarification I'm seeking here is that in previous projections we've seen, it was based on the amount of funding you expected to have at community college. Is this figure a projection of demand as opposed to how much you can serve with the money that's going to be available?
Madam Chair, Senator Mesley, it's an excellent question. This this is our expectation of the demand at nearly 106. Funding won't support that number. Slide 9 is just a review of the budget that we currently have, and I would apologize to the committee that there are a lot of different budget numbers now. Given Thursday and Friday's announcements, these are the governor's balanced budget numbers. But we expect to have about $398 million to distribute as aid to the community colleges. That leads us to slide 10, which is the enrollment scenario given that dollar amount. Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have any indication of what the governor's rebalance will be to these figures? Or is this including that?
Does Madam Chair, Senator Mesley, if you would look at the 2%, which is the second of the step downs in the projections, the second line, that's $90,165. Mm-hmm. The governor's budget reduces the support fund by 2.4%. That's the closest number we have to that at the 2% reduction.
Thank you.
I'd like to move on and talk a little about tuition and fees. We have Mr. Bender has shared with the committee the increase in tuition over the past year has been about 12%. Just a reminder that the tuition and fee rates are set by local boards. Right now, the average cost is for a full-time student is about $2,300. It ranges by credit hour from 40 to 55, and we do project a $10 increase statewide for the next year. The chart on page 12 is just a further example of the increasing tuition. We do want to make sure that the committee understands that the student share of their education has increased in the last decade from something around 20 to 22% to now over 30%. Slide 13 is gratuitous, I would admit, but it is our attempt to show the committee the difference between community college tuition and that of the university system. And this particular graph is grouped by geographic area so that the committee can see that someone in Eastern Oregon going to Blue Mountain or Treasure Valley or Eastern. The difference, since I didn't want to do public math, is a low of about $1,300 in tuition difference to a high of about $2,000 difference. Slide 14 is a enrollment projection given the two proposals that two budget proposals that are now I would say on the table. The top one is the co-chair's budget as discussed on the 17th, and the third line down is again to Senator Meserle's earlier question, the 2% or 2.4% reduction. We're going to move now to how the community colleges use federal funds to leverage their activities. I want to point to the placard that we have for you today, which does talk more about, in at least in headlines, how the community colleges use adult basic ed funds and Perkins professional technical dollars to augment and enhance the programs that they deliver. Again, they certainly leverage that what is about $20 million that comes to the state biennially to service to Oregonians. Quickly, professional technical programs comes from federal Carl Perkins dollars. It is resources that does not serve students directly, but instead is used to really build state-of-the-art programs to ensure that students in professional technical programs have the cutting-edge technology that they need and best practices as they are evolving so that they are competitive in the workforce. Slide 17 reminds the committee that the split of Carl Perkins dollars that comes to the state of Oregon is 50-50. 50% goes to Oregon's high schools, and 50% goes to community colleges. The fund is distributed in grant and aid. Statewide activities that we have used the Carl Perkins Fund are to ensure the seamlessness of professional technical programs from high school to colleges. We have a number of K-12 and community college demonstrations projects that include, as listed here, information technology, teacher and paraprofessional preparation, engineering, and with a lot of effort, the healthcare. In our organizational chart, we are requesting in our budget the addition of one staff position. We currently don't have any staff that are dedicated to Carl Perkins. We contract that staff with the Department of Education there through the Office of Professional Technical Education, and they do a fine job for us. But as the pace of change increases in the community colleges, we think it would be most appropriate for us to have a specialist on our staff that could maintain and actually increase the dialogue between community colleges and K-12 through our staff.
Senator Meserle.
Is there a difference in the amount of funding required, whether you contract or have permanent staff?
Madam Chair, Senator Meserle, no, not really, just our ability to direct their work more closely. Moving on to slide 19, another resource, federal resources that the colleges receive is adult education and family literacy. This is Title II of the Workforce Investment Act. Slide 19 tells you what the purpose of this fund is. It is, as the title would indicate, increased literacy. This is a program that's funded at about $9.8 million, and it the literacy services it provides is just a fraction of what is available. We serve about 26,000 students a year with this program through the community colleges. Slide 20 tries to communicate to the committee the real demand of literacy services. We have nearly 10% of Oregon's population does not have a high school credential, and nearly half of the 200 plus thousand who don't have a high school credential actually have less than a ninth grade education. So the need for this service far outstrips our ability to fund it and provide it. Slide 21 talks about most specifically the services that are provided for with the funds that we receive and provide to the community colleges, basic education instruction, and support for the GED, family literacy and workplace literacy, and ESL particularly. Providers are primarily the 17 community colleges, but we do have some community-based organizations or coalitions, the Department of Corrections, and we have 14 small contracts with local and county jails for the delivery of family literacy services. Slide 23 then starts to unpack who is that 26,000 that are served, what kind of services, and you can see nearly half of the services basic skills, 11,000 limited English speakers, that number is on the rise, and GED services. The organizational chart on slide 24 gives you a picture of the four individuals that are primarily responsible for delivering adult family literacy, adult education and family literacy in the state. As we did with the federal one-stop program, we want to make sure that the committee is aware that there are challenges with this program, and most of them are directly related to the lack of resources. Under the reauthorization of the Federal Workforce Investment Act, funds for this program are held pretty steady. We do expect that today will be announced a rescission across the board for all programs that were in the HHS budget that was approved, of about somewhere between 2.6 and 3%, so just across the board reductions. And I believe the intended purpose is homeland security. Another set of services that community colleges provide with partners is the Small Business Development Center. This is not in our budget. This funds for the Small Business Development Centers is actually in the Economic and Community Development budget, but because community colleges provide about half of the funding at the local level for Small Business Development Centers, we thought it was important to round out for the committee a view of what all that included. There are 16 community colleges and 3 state universities that deliver Small Business Development Center services. It's an extraordinary program that leveraging resources with over 10,000 businesses assisted in Oregon. And you do have at your place a more in-depth report that was provided by the Small Business Development Centers. I'm not going to go into this in detail because it is not in our budget, but it is there for your information. The slide on page 27 gives you a view of the services that are provided to business owners and what some of the major service areas are. And we will have an individual small business person here in just a little bit to talk about the services. Slide 28 gives you a view of what makes up the SBDC network's budget. About 27% of it comes from the state. That is the budget from the in the Department of Community and Economic Development. There is about 24% that is federal, and that's from the Small Business Administration. And then about 50% is the match that colleges and universities provide at $3.9 million. Finishing up our presentation, Madam Chair and members of the committee, did want to point out what is probably very obvious, is that access to a post-secondary education is at risk for Oregonians, primarily because of our funding situation. This slide shows that a similar graph was displayed when the university system was here, and we have added our projected ability to serve, or demand, as Senator Meserle coined it, with where we expect to be. Slide 30 is just further evidence of the need for the increasing demand of highly skilled workers. The Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development had some rather pithy quotes for us about what it's going to take to be the knowledge economy of the 21st century, as well as the healthcare task force that finished its report last year. It's that we have critical shortages in critical fields, and we simply lack the capacity to fill them. The challenges on page 31. We have a plethora of nursing and allied health programs all across the state, but they are full. And we, even through partnering with hospitals and other health services, we are unable to meet the demand. We do have considerable waiting lists, depending on the college, as many as 300 individuals waiting in line to receive English as a second language classes. And we have physical plants around the state that are called community college campuses that are in dire need of repair and expansion. The state has not made any sizable investment for at least the last 15 years. We talked just a moment ago about professional technical programs and training for high-skilled workforce. This is what it looks like because of funding reductions. These are the programs that have been suspended or deleted in the last 18 months. Representative Bates, when he was here when we started, wanted to know what were the options available to the department and to the legislature, given the situation we find ourselves. It goes without saying, more money would be nice. Many of the colleges have increased their reliance on other funds and grants, increasing that from right now is approximately 5 to 6% of a community college budget. And the investment at the 17 community colleges as a whole are over a $1 billion business in the state of Oregon. And 6% of that is this little piece of grants and other programs. Colleges will continue to do what cost savings they can around staff and programs and courses. And, of course, there are tuition strategies, and we've already discussed those. I want to finish with the socioeconomic benefits of your investment in community colleges. We did have a return on investment study done. Each of the colleges paid a share of having an independent third party come in and look at the college. This contractor had actually done this in about eight other states, eight other areas, had never done a state before. Oregon was the first statewide look at return on investment. For every dollar Oregon invests, we have a 17% return on investment. And we actually believe that your investment in community colleges improves the health of the state because it does reduce welfare, unemployment, and crime by almost $62 million a year. But they aren't just for the state. They are also for the individual. The individual benefits by an increase in wages and a likelihood of unemployment at half what someone without some college experience would expect. I'd like to move now to a very short video, because we made the decision not to bring before the committee someone who was an adult basic and family literacy participant, someone who was receiving ESL services. This film clip runs through those individuals, as well as professional, technical, and other program services that community colleges provide. Thank you.
I grew up in Malala, up in the hills. I was the last house on my road, in the trees and in the country. College was never really talked about with my family very much. And I actually was married at 19. I have two kids, 8 and 7 now, and they're both in school. I'm recently divorced, 1.5 years, and now it's my time to go to school and get my education and start my own job, career. My kids are very excited that I'm a firefighter. They see the fire trucks, and they get excited that I do that I'm on the engine, that I get dressed up the way that they do, and they tell their friends at school that their mom is a firefighter. So it's pretty cool. I'm excited to get a job in a fire department, that I can develop a family with them and learn and grow and just constantly improve myself in something that I love.
What's important to me in my life is making a difference in other people's lives, being able to impact someone. We're always called out to the worst times in people's lives, and that's why they call us. And if for that split second I can make someone forget about the pain or think of something else and distract them from that or ease the pain, I've done my job, and it makes me feel great.
My father went to Shemeketa Community College several years ago, and he majored in visual communications and art. And being still in high school, I didn't realize that Shemeketa was such a great school, so I never even thought about attending here. But now that I am going here, I see him as being 100% right about how good this school is. And I think he was so right when he was saying that it was such a good environment, and the staff are wonderful. The staff really know what they're talking about. Attending here and then wanting to transfer to Portland State, they make the whole transition easier by having joint enrollment, where I'm also registered as a student in Portland State. And I also have a counselor, and they have my transcripts all set up. So as I am being a first-year student here at Shemeketa, I'm also a student at Portland State.
When I was a senior at North, we had a couple graduating seniors the year before come back and say Shemeketa was a great place, and they recommended Shemeketa to all the students in the class and actually gave us a spiel on how good Shemeketa was, so, and how good the instructors were. When I first started here at Shemeketa, I imagined being a big business person, and that changed quickly when I heard about the nursing shortage, so now I'm actually going into the nursing program to actually use my business skills working with people and nursing skills. So
something that I can imagine in the future. Maybe 7 or 8 years from now, it's like having my own company, being my own boss, doing graphic design, anything about graphic design, and having my BMW, my car. My husband and I wanted to take a computer class because we were going to get a computer, and we didn't know anything about how a computer, how to make a computer function. We found that the first class was opening up basic skills, and that's what we needed. Sometimes you know just exactly what to do, and sometimes it's just a brick wall. But there's a lot that a computer has to offer, and I've got lots more to learn.
We was a graduation from GD, and I'm part of that program in Spanish in Woodbury. And the director of the program, Elias Villegas, was mentioning people that were getting scholarships, and suddenly I heard my name, and you can imagine how it was for me. I am the first one in attending college, and if you could see my parents' faces when I told them that I came to school, to college. It was a dream to make it up. Now it becomes like my second family.
I'd been working for Caterpillar 8 years, and in the summer of 99, I'd gotten a notice that they were going to close the plant. I was going to be out of a job. My first thought was to look for another engineering job, but I had previously read about a new viticulture program at Chemeketa, and the more I thought about that, the more appealing it sounded to me, and I thought, well, if I'm going to make a career change, this is the time to do it. For me, it's turned out to be a very positive experience. I didn't, you know, there was times I had my doubts along the way, but I'm really happy I tried something new. It's been great. I could have gotten back into my engineering field career and kept going, and I'm sure I would have been happy and content there. But at the same time, this new career has just opened up so many avenues to me. It's been a real growth for me in my life. It's made me look at things a lot differently, and it's been a very positive experience, and I'm glad I didn't back away just because it was something different.
TED Center really helped us to define our market and to hone in on what differentiated us from other contractors, other architects, and that was key to our success. Having the tools available to us through the TED Center really helped us grow into what that differentiated market was for the company, and that is why we're successful, I think. Since I'm one of these people that works 24/7, they were able to accommodate my frenetic schedule by using email and telephones and in-person consultation in an effective way for me around my schedule, and that was ideal and critical to our development early on in the process especially.
We were in need of some training funds, so we obviously needed to recruit people and train them. And SEDCOR got involved with the TED Center and went to the state and got a grant to help us with that. And also the TED Center provided the training and did the recruiting of people and the interviewing of people for us and helped us through that process. We're rated one of the highest plants in warehousing from a safety standpoint, from a productivity standpoint. Our productivity measures, we've significantly passed all of those, and the plant has simply come up much quicker from a waste standpoint and from a productivity standpoint than any other startup that we've had, and is now pretty much rivaling the plant that we have in Indianapolis, and it's only been operating for roughly a year and a half, and the plant in Indianapolis has been functional since roughly 94. So all measures we can give the plant, this has been an outstanding startup for us.
Shemeika just had a relationship with Intel with me on the other side of the partnership for about 12 years, since 1990. But Shemeika graduates have gone to Intel since Intel's been in Oregon. And we actually did a study. One of the teachers came and did a summer internship and was curious about where some of the people had gone. And he found that they had moved up quite a ways in a lot of places within the organization. In fact, when you go into the lab today, you can see a bulletin board that has business cards of the graduates, and they're in wonderful positions, not only within Intel, but within organizations all over the state and the country. So Shemeika graduates could go almost anywhere. Although we're greedy, we'd like to take as many of them as we can get.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to make sure that I thank Shemeika Community College for the use of this tape. And I think it goes without saying that you would find as many stories at the other 16 colleges as you found here. We were just able to have this one on tape and bring it to you in a nice bite size. Having said that, I would like to ask Cheryl Heinerman, the last person on the tape, to join me at the table with a little more detail about the partnership between Oregon's community colleges and the semiconductor industry.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Chair, distinguished members of the committee, I'm here on behalf of the community colleges. I am Cheryl Heinerman. I'm Human Capital Development Manager at Intel Corporation. I do workforce development projects on behalf of technology workers worldwide for Intel in manufacturing and engineering. I've also been three times chair of the Semiconductor Workforce Consortium, a partnership of community colleges and agency representatives from the state and members from our industry panels, both chip makers and silicon wafer makers and vendors and suppliers who support workers in our industry in Oregon. I'm also a member of the Governor's Workforce Investment Board. I care deeply about the community college system and how it's funded in our state. I have nothing but praise for the partnerships that we have around the state with the community colleges. Just for an example, you've heard me speak of Shemeika on the video, and I'm very proud of them. They've been one of our top three providers of Intel technicians since we began working with them in 90 on specialized programs. And they approach technology education with a core curriculum that has up to four, now soon to be five, options that meet and exceed workforce needs. Umpqua Community College in Roseburg is a stellar community college. The Digital Systems Technology Program has the highest interview to job offer ratio of any of the technology programs that Intel works with in any of the states that we have manufacturing facilities. It's in the high 90s every time. And I think that speaks to providing job opportunities to people who attend colleges in rural areas in Oregon, that they have access to jobs, tremendous jobs, here in our state and outside. I've also worked long and hard with Portland Community College, and we have many school programs there for our own employees, as well as three technology programs that we work with in electronics, microelectronics, and facilities maintenance. And just a word on the charting and the funding. Although Portland Community College is the largest, and you may think of it as a single college, when we as industry people work with it, we're really working with four or five colleges because of the way they're divided and situated around the city and around the county. So don't always think of them as one entity leveraging, but we very often have to work with different systems. So you might want to look at the money in that regard, too, and how they have to respond in a large urban area. Columbia Gorge Community College, as I sat on their advisory board, I was thoroughly impressed with how the community, and I think that's the operative word here in all of these colleges, came together to support a technology electronics program that provides graduates not only for Intel in our industry, but for Bonneville Dam, Army Corps of Engineers, and the distribution power centers. They saw the need to provide technology jobs for their folks, and they also invited industry people to share where the shortages and needs were and responded beautifully to those needs. Clackamas also provides to us an extremely unique program in high-purity water systems. They took their environmental and water program and added an option for people who are coming to work in our industry in the state. There's a critical need for water technologists because we use highly pure water in our processing. They have a program now that's unique west of the Mississippi. So I think if you look at how the community colleges listen, look, and respond to the workforce needs in their state and their region, and they're not afraid to be innovative and powerful enough to be known for in other states, so they can be destination places for people to come. I think that as an OWERB member, we have often talked about the crisis in funding in the last year. It's been high on our agenda many, many times. I think the workforce readiness in Oregon may definitely erode, and that is a big fear we have as workforce board members. If the colleges are not fully funded to sustain themselves and not only just survive but thrive in this economic downturn, one of the critical needs they have is to educate and train faculty for critical shortages that are impending. I've been presenting papers to the State Board of Education since 1994 because we could see it coming. Many of our key and critical faculty are ready to retire within the next 3 to 5 years, and then what happens? We don't really see a succession plan, and even though there are education programs for faculty, they're not full to support the needs that we see coming, particularly in healthcare shortages. Kim already explained to you that with the nursing shortages that we have, we still have women and men lined up outside the doors waiting to get into college, and there's no room. And I asked a bold question one day at the board meeting, well, why don't we run day swing and night shift classes? Because after all, the nursing people understand this kind of schedule, and they will probably be happy to go day swing and night. And the answer was, we have no teachers. So we could certainly focus dollars on getting teachers to support programs that were around the clock to fill this workforce need. That's critical. I think often what worries us is the budgets for education seem to be very heavily in favor of K through 12, which is not a problem really, except that when the universities are funded, people naturally assume that includes the community colleges, and it does not. Their budgets are separate. And we often see that the community college budgets are the poor country cousin. They get less. And yet their need is critical. The people that they teach, train, educate, and work with are key workers that really weave the fabric in our society. They train and educate nurses, auto mechanics, dental, and medical technicians, and the technology workers that build our homes, appliances, tools, and the piece part technology that we use every day. We do have infrastructure in place in Oregon with 17 community colleges around the state, so they are available and they're well used, as Ken's chart showed you. People do know about them, work with them, and use them. And in most of the states, because Oregon has been an early responder of the Workforce Investment Act, they've struggled long and hard to streamline funding streams and to partner with how they would respond in the community to workforce education and training, so that we're not wasting a lot of money on budgetary bureaucracy, but on getting real money to people to learn and to get jobs and to be trained. And I think in Oregon we've seen it. It's not just emerging workers or current workers, but transitional workers, because the jobs in our world change. And just because you learned something 10 years ago doesn't mean you're going to be ready for the job that's here tomorrow. And so you have to be in a responsive mode, and that's where we do that with our community college partners. They can turn on a dime. They can work with us. They can listen, and they can change a curriculum in just a few months and have it be worthwhile and have it meet a need and have it be inclusive. In strong economic years, industry partners have been able to take up the slack that we see in lack of funding through the state. But this is, as you well know, the third to the fourth year now of a very low economic cycle worldwide. And so we really can't afford a double burden where our budgets are cut too. And so I think now both the state and industry need to partner so that these programs aren't cut to extinction. I was sad to see how many are already cut. I think one of the things we need to look at long and hard is how those model programs that have blended their curriculum with articulations with the technology, professional technical education programs from high school to community college, and then link them to higher ed. They provide a real, true career and education pathway for people to begin very small in the high school level and go as far as they, as their heart desires, as their needs emerge. And often, industries like ours will pay tuition reimbursement for people to continue their schooling. We pay 100%. So people can come into our world with a two-year degree and go as long and far as they need to or want to, and not make final choices. I think a lot of the K-12 people think that professional technical means final choice, and it does not. Because we're working with the community college who are also transfer credit folks, they make sure that the science, the math, and technology courses will take them further than a two-year degree. So I'm asking you to really look carefully at the funding for the community colleges and not cut them short at a time when we critically need them so badly. Thank you.
Madam Chair. Senator Gordley. Thank you, and thank you for your testimony. I would like to address briefly the budget slash revenue question or crisis that you mentioned in your testimony, and this is a FYI. There is a measure in the House, House Bill 3608. It is a sales tax which would dedicate revenue to pre-kindergarten through community colleges. It is a measure which has been introduced by Representative Gary Hansen and myself. We have a commitment from Representative Shetterly to hear that sales tax measure along with another sales tax measure that he and Representative Max Williams are working on. So there is hope. We hope that you will get behind one or both of those measures, and we hope that Intel will join us in this effort as well. This is not the Revenue Committee. I'm very well aware of that. But we are in a crisis. We do need to be looking for solutions, and the sales tax may be one of those solutions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone?
Madam Chair, with what I see we have about 10 minutes left, I would also like to invite Tom Marks and Lisa Taylor up.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Marks. I'm a business advisor at the Chemeketa Small Business Development Center. It's my pleasure to introduce you to Lisa Taylor today. She is came to the Small Business Development Center through a self-employment assistance program, which works with the Oregon Employment Department. Rather than people, when they become unemployed, going out and knocking on doors looking for jobs, they have the opportunity to enroll in this program where they access our services and classes, attend classes on learning how to write a business plan. So Lisa came through our program, and she entered in August and then opened up her own business in mid-November. So I'd like to have Lisa tell you a little bit about her story.
Good morning, Ms. Taylor. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I was, July 23rd, I was laid off from a full-time job with Advanced Telecom Group as a call center administrator. The very next day, I got a call from the manager of my part-time job at Art Impressions Plus, and she told me that they were going to close the store in a few months. I'm like, two jobs, 12 hours, not good. I stood there in shock, of course, for a while and realized that Salem then had no art rubber stamp store in, for an hour north or south. They'd have to travel. I knew I had to open a stamp store. So I had already dropped off my paperwork for unemployment benefits and contacted Chuck Sackey with the Employment Division and said, hey, do I qualify for this cool program that my other friends are on, referring to the Self-Employment Assistance Program? No, you don't qualify. I'm sorry. Your name didn't make the list. Oh, okay. So I went ahead and still looked for a job while trying to figure out how am I going to open this business, because it has to happen. And a week later, or no, within the week, Chuck called me and said, hey, your name's on the list. You officially qualify for self-employment assistance. Yay, I can now dedicate my time to building this business instead of having to do a job and this. So I was able to focus on that. And with having the self-employment assistance, the unemployment check coming every week, it was a huge load off of my mind. The requirement in order to get that pay is you have to go to the weekly class of writing your business plan. Well, that's not a problem. I needed help writing it anyway. And the folks down at the Small Business Development Center were fantastic. I learned a lot about not only writing the plan, but the marketing information, different resources, places to get things. It was absolutely fantastic. And we opened the store mid-November. I'm gearing up for my six-month anniversary sale now. In the meantime, I've grown my customer database over 40% from the one that I acquired with Art Impressions Plus. I have a lot of repeat customers that take a lot of classes and they come back to the shop. My customers are very good to me. I'm very lucky for the support I have. But they always comment that the store is very inviting and shoppable. And I know that I wouldn't be here today with owning my own business if I hadn't had the support of the Small Business Development Center and the SBA program. It made a big difference to Stampin' Cat Studio. Thank you.
Questions or comments? How long have you been in business now?
Well, I'm in the middle of my fifth month of the doors being open. So, plugging right along.
Well, having a small business background myself, I know that you're in for things that you have no idea.
Oh, I know. I've found a few already.
Like paperwork?
Lots. So.
So do you get ongoing support from the Small Business Development Center?
Yes, I do. Yeah. Tom stops in every once in a while and checks in on me, and then I also contact them for brainstorming different ideas on how do I get the word out, you know, what are some different financing things I can do. So I do stay in contact with them.
Well, I think I share with the members of this committee our wishes for the greatest good luck in your business endeavors. It's great to see people take that leap of faith and start a business.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we are finished with the formal presentation portion of our budget and look forward to tomorrow with public testimony.
Are there any final comments for Cam? Representative Mark.
Actually, I had a question. I don't know if it's easy to do. If it is, great. If not, don't do it. But you're not.
What a setup.
Well, you know, it's your map that showed community college students and headcounts basically by county and percentage population. I wondered if you could convert that to FTE by county, if that was easily done. And just because it seemed like there was the FTE ratio to students was different in depending on the schools, and I thought that might be an interesting. But
other questions or comments? I will close the public hearing on House Bill 5009, and tomorrow we have public comments. Do you have any further announcements, Mr. Bender? With that, I will adjourn the committee meeting. We'll reconvene at 8:30 tomorrow morning.